to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. There is no religion higher than truth. This is the motto of the Theosophical Society in America, founded in New York in 1875 with three main purposes: to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color, to encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science, and to investigate the unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent within the human being. The Society is composed of students belonging to any religion or to none, rooted in ageless wisdom and engaging knowledge that is religious, scientific, and esoteric. Their bond is not the profession of a common belief, but a common search and aspiration for truth. The Society has had a tremendous impact on spiritual culture in the West, and joining us today to discuss theosophy is Tim Boyd, president of the Theosophical Society in America. Tim, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Care, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, first, as a way in, as a little door, a glimpse, I'm wondering if you may have a personal story or memory or an aha moment that can give us a glimpse into the wonder of theosophy.
Well, probably there are a number of things that could fit that category, but just for me personally, my exposure to theosophy began with meeting a particular individual who was very much active in the theosophical study and seems to have been someone who had kind of incorporated in his living. So just through a chance meeting, I happened to have two evenings of where he discussed things with me and went into it in some depth. And I had an opportunity to go away and think about it, and it really, of all places for this kind of change in point of view to have occurred, it occurred in a park in New York City. When I was thinking about the many things he had said to me a couple of nights before, and just really just quite suddenly had a complete opening of a different way of understanding. You know, later I would come to see it as what's often described as some sort of mystical experience. But it was something that caused me to see just life in general in a very, very different light. And one of the things that it showed me was that there was a deeper way to explore it, which led me back to this, the value of the teachings that I was to find in theosophy.
Mm. Thank you so much. A mystical experience in a park in New York City. Don't you love that?
It does happen.
It does, I know. Now, let's start with a beginning place here. Now, what is theosophy, and perhaps even an etymology of the word itself?
Well, the word it's in two parts, and it's theo and sophia. So you could describe it as divine wisdom or the wisdom like that of the gods is one way that it's described. But it's something where it has been an approach to the underlying, you could say, an underlying understanding of the world and the cosmos that's been around for quite a while. If you were to actually try and put a date on it, there's certainly what we would call modern theosophy, which
right.
I'm sure we'll talk about as we go along, which had its beginnings in the 1870s. But prior to that, there have been these sorts of explorations that have found that there is a unity which underlies the world's religions. And now, of course, in the scientific age, we include science, philosophy as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Now, yes, of course, it comes back to the ancients,
mm-hmm.
I imagine. But let's discuss the Theosophical Society in America, and where did it have its beginnings?
Well, the Theosophical Society in America is just one section in a worldwide Theosophical Society, which is in 70 countries worldwide. But the actual Theosophical Society had its beginnings in New York, again, in New York City. Maybe that's how I had that.
It's a vortex there.
we don't need Sedona after all.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, it began in 1875 in New York City. And it was a group of people who got together. Mainly the focus was through Helena Blavatsky, who wanted to explore some of these ideas that came to be known as theosophy in our time. Mm. But as I say, the Theosophical Society in America is one branch of that, and it has its headquarters in Wheaton, Illinois.
Mm, thank you. Yes, and it's in many countries around the world.
Yeah.
And makes an appearance in a film called Fairy Tale, where a theosophist was involved with the story, which was a true story, of the two little girls in Yorkshire, England, who claimed that they photographed fairies.
Oh, right, right.
And the
I
theosophist
haven't seen that
was right in there because of the openness to exploring that.
Yes.
And taking it seriously.
Yes, I remember those photographs, which were quite widely acclaimed, and then also equally widely acclaimed as manufactured later on.
Yeah, well, yes, but you see, that's where it comes together, the faith or belief, mm-hmm. Coupled with the science.
Yeah.
And seeking through the disciplines, as it were, for the truth.
Yeah.
So then, what does a theosophist seek? What is it that is a goal in the lifestyle, in the practice?
Well, I think probably the thing that would be, you could say, would unite theosophists in terms of an outlook would be this whole concept of the oneness of life, which was expressed in the first object of the Theosophical Society under the terms of universal brotherhood, the idea that there is something which unites not only human beings, but really all life exists within some sort of greater whole. And theosophy, in a way, exists to not just explain, give a description of that greater whole, but to actually assist in having the experience of what it means. Hmm. So that's it functions on the level of various levels of knowledge, you could say.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's an intellectual base to it, a conceptual base, and then there's also an experiential aspect.
And then I imagine there's a more mysterious aspect as well, or contemplation on the nature of divinity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately,
yeah.
Anything that's worth taking your time up with should have some sort of mystery to it, something that's beyond what we can know.
Okay, so that's a positive thing because, of course, many find comfort in religious or spiritual practices that seem to nail things down.
Yeah. Well, I think that probably one of the things that has been very attractive to me, at least, and maybe it just suits my temperament, about the theosophical worldview and approach is that it does, in fact, provide for what we all recognize to be true, that people experience the world through various different sorts of filters, so we're all developed differently. So that, you know, it's not necessary for some people to feel that they have to have a confined and prescribed approach to reality.
Mm.
For others, sometimes there's a necessity to have some sort of guidelines that will help us to form our behavior and at least minimally have it so we act and treat each other nicely.
Mm.
So,
yes.
Well, I mean, we all find ourselves at different points along that scale.
Yes. Now, I've read that theosophy attempts to reconcile humanity's scientific, philosophical, and religious disciplines and practices rather with a unified worldview. What is it that needs to be reconciled? I'm interested in that, and what is the inspiration for this?
Well, I could say certainly at the time that the the modern-day Theosophical Society came into being, which is, again, was the 1870s, it was really at a period where scientific worldview was really becoming preeminent. You know, for ages before, you know, it was the religious world that sort of defined how anyone was going to see reality. But one of the issues and one of the reasons for the motivation for the development of a Theosophical Society was the fact that this scientific worldview was really going into a very almost completely materialistic view of the nature of life, really, that it all was rooted in material sorts of causes. And so the greatest minds were the ones who were being attracted to that sort of point of view. And so at that particular time, it seemed as if there was really a need to redirect our point of view and to remind the thinkers of the world that there is, in fact, much more that is unseen, much more that is beyond the scope of current capacity to explain. And so that was something that sort of reconciliation was necessary, you know, from a materialistic point of view to one that was perhaps more open to the world of consciousness, mind, you know, all the sorts of things that we see and people have experienced routinely, but don't quite fall within the power to explain of a materialistic point of view. So that was one of the things that needed to be reconciled.
Thank you so much for that, Tim. I relate to that on many levels. As you were speaking, various things came to mind about the world, you know, or the culture that we live in today, where, you know, there's so much focus on material things and specific aspects of ourselves that are largely, you know, just purely physical. People being very concerned about it, like, for example, a BMI measurement of your body. I'm not kidding.
And don't forget,
and so much energy.
Abs of steel.
Abs of steel or some kind of alloy. And, you know, the focus placed on social media, in fact, some obsession placed on these things to the point where you wonder, you know, where the meaning is. What's the meaning puzzle that is not necessarily solved with this? And so, you know, I looked at Theosophy and, you know, one of the, you know, the objects of exploring the unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent within the human being. This is a powerful goal and like a reminder to me of perhaps how narrow our scope has become. You know, I tell the story sometimes about doing a little trek, you know, through England and coming across the stone circle of Avebury. And there's a light meter on the camera, and how odd it was that if you put the light meter down at the stone where it meets the ground, it read higher than holding the camera up to the horizon. And perhaps that's sort of a Theosophist moment of the mystery of things. But, you know, there just seems to be so much more out there, not just to us, but, you know, the earth and our relationship to the world that we can really miss.
Yeah, and I think that there are very few people that don't recognize that. I think one of the issues that affects most of us today is that there are certain things that we could call, in a way, maybe not common sense, but a deeper sort of sense of what's real and what actually goes on than is allowed for in normal sorts of avenues of thought. I mean, everybody, it just takes just a very minimal sort of research of, you know, such things as extrasensory perception. You know, it's described as extrasensory perception, but certainly it's things that everybody has experiences of walking into the presence of someone who, you know, you maybe have never met, and then suddenly feeling down or depressed or feeling very happy. And, you know, just this sort of way of sensing things that are not physical at all. And then, of course, there are the examples of people who have developed that to a very fine sort of skill, where they're able to really look at and perceive even things such as colors and auras surrounding people, or even see the nature of the future or the past. But those are things that many people would regard as some of the unexplained aspects, and some might even regard it as powers that are latent within.
Mm.
Probably those are abilities that everyone has that probably at some point will be expressed. But I wouldn't really look at those so much as the real powers that are latent within.
Right.
Because I tend to think, and, you know, this is a point of view that I think is supported in most of what would be described as theosophy, that when you really start talking about the things that are powers, you move to another realm. And so you start getting into these sorts of words. And one that the Dalai Lama is very fond of using, this word compassion, that's of the nature of a power, a kindness, love, wisdom. These are things that are really latent within each and every one of us.
Mm.
But, you know, often what happens is, particularly in today's world, we find ourselves recognizing that such powers exist, but we don't quite have time to cultivate it. I have to get to my second job. The baby's crying. You know, everybody's busy. And so a lot of these things lay fallow. So those are the real powers. And then there are other sorts of abilities that also are quite common in humanity.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because when, you know, we talk about the power of love, you know, we might say that's where we come from, you know, in terms of an origin. And then living this life can become a process of sort of containing it till it's rather subdued in us, and then having to practice remembering now where we came from. Now, the theosophy movement, I'll refer to it as, has been sort of accredited with inspiring tremendous growth spiritually and even in the entire New Age movement that was experienced and continues to be. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's completely accurate.
Yeah? Could you share more?
Well, yeah. Again, when you talk about where these things had their beginnings, you go back to 1875, and the term, for instance, which is on everybody's lips these days, karma, I mean, it's in the dictionary now, and we take it for granted. But that's one of those terms that was quite a foreign idea, the idea that there are, in fact, throughout everything that we experience, that there are causes and there are effects, and that the whole function is one of bringing things into balance. So this idea of karma, which is just at the core of so many of what you might describe as New Age ideas, that was one of the concepts that came with theosophy, reincarnation as a, or the cyclical nature of life, is something that was really introduced into the thinking, Western thinking.
Yeah.
So those sorts of things that are the staples, and the idea of a spiritual unfoldment or evolution and the possibility for people to cooperate in their own self-unfoldment was an idea that was also quite foreign.
Right.
And then, you know, the thing that now, of course, has become quite a movement of interfaith, the idea that all of the religions of the world have value and that they all, although it often isn't expressed this way, that they all have come into being at different places, in different cultural settings, different times, and have expressed timeless truths in the language that has been most familiar to the people to which it was given.
Mm.
So the idea that there is this kind of unity, a voice among all of the world's religions, was something that was really had its roots with the Theosophical Society as well.
Mm. Now, you mentioned truth, and the motto of the society is there is no religion higher than truth. Can you share a little more about the importance and the role and the goal of truth in the Theosophical tradition?
Mm-hmm. Well, truth is one of those things that you can talk about it on a number of levels, but obviously when you talk about there is no religion higher than truth, you're talking about what many people describe as big T truth. You know?
Yes, yes.
That the truth that exists above and beyond all of our musings about it. Robert Frost, who's a poet that I liked a lot,
yeah.
One of the first poems I had to commit to memory was Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. You probably know that one.
Oh, yeah.
But he had something that is echoed in many different spiritual approaches. He said, truth sits at the center and knows. We stand at the circumference and suppose. So the idea that we are formulating different ideas about something which is really central, that cannot actually be fully explained, but that everybody recognizes is that there is such a thing as an underlying fabric of existence, and that there is a pattern that is orderly and that emanates from this that we could call this kind of central truth. And the religions of the world come into being to speak about that, and perhaps when they're doing their job properly, to guide us toward that.
Or create a forum for that to emerge in, you know, throughout the different cultures and religions if it's allowed to be raised up.
Well, exactly.
You know.
And again, I say when they're functioning properly.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's, you know, and that's a big question, and that's what we talk about here. We find that the most conversations about religion tend to remain a mental opinion or disagreement or point of confrontation, and believe very strongly that nothing can proceed from there.
Yeah.
So we approach the, you know, our work here and also on the program with the literal, you know, meaning of the word obedience, which means to hear someone out, to listen.
Mm.
It's what it actually means, I know, to listen and to listen seriously.
That's not the way my mother told me.
Isn't that? See, you get so many revelations here on the Godspeed Institute. But so we want to hear, you know, what people believe, and then we find that common ground.
Yeah.
And the truths that can emerge like different jewels along that circle, you know, around the center that you mentioned. Now, some of the kind of questions a theosophist might ask, let's say, would be like, what is the true and universal reality? These are ontological questions. What are the universal concepts between mind and reality? You go into metaphysics. Morality. Questions like how do we apply universal truth to further humanity, and what does science allow or deny within that universal reality? These are fascinating questions and an approach to all these matters that find their place within theosophy, sort of like equal pillars.
Well, that's true.
You know, but how can we, as diverse as we are, concur on a universal truth, or do we need to?
Well, I don't think that we're ever going to get everyone standing together and singing Kumbaya the same together the same
tune. You know?
I don't think it's going to happen, perhaps. I mean, ultimately, yes, but we're talking very long range ultimately.
Yeah.
Because I lived in Chicago for a number of years, and many, many years ago at least, this particular street has changed. But there used to be a particular street where they had what was called storefront churches, which was basically what it says, little storefronts where some business had gone out of business and then a church would come in, and they'd have a little congregation. And there were like about two blocks where you'd have a storefront church, a grocery store, a liquor store, another storefront church. And you could go there on a Sunday. And every one of them would have people in there. And every one of them would have a slightly different approach to, you know, the worship and the expression of God.
Yeah.
But the idea for me was every single one of those suited the need of the people that were in there. And might have even been viewed as in opposition to the one next door.
Right.
But they were all essentially, they existed to fill the need of the people to whom that particular approach spoke. And we all have these different sorts of levels of development. So there are people who come to religious organizations and need the structure of that.
Right.
There are people who have followed the kind of ascetic or monastic tradition whose world they seek is within. And then you have people who just do perhaps a meditative approach where it's all thought from from an inward perspective, inward experience. But what you find, at least what I've found, is that the people that you encounter who you could say have some sort of genuine experience of this deeper reality, you find them in every religion. It's not most of us, but you find them in every religion. But when you get them together, once they get away from a subject of theology and actually start talking about their experience of God or of the infinite, they're not starting wars over those things.
Right.
They're able to discuss and to communicate in a shared language. And that's why I would say that that's not the experience of most. And until that is, then we're always going to have some level of controversy or misunderstanding. But the key is to, you know, how we manage to deal with this process of gradual unfoldment. And it is very, very gradual.
The process of gradual unfoldment.
Yeah.
I like that phrase. Thank you, Tim. We're about halfway through the program. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from our break, we will continue our conversation with Tim Boyd, president of the Theosophical Society in America. Let's spend a few minutes now with an old classic. Stay with us.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your dad's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know he never will. You know he never will. And the patches make the goodbye hardest hit. Very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see better days, will you carry the words of a love with you? Will you ride the great white bird into heaven? And though you want to last forever, you know you never will. You know you never will. Goodbye makes the journey harder still.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You're live with CARE, and we're talking with Tim Boyd, president of the Theosophical Society in America, and that was, of course, Cat Stevens And I love the line in that song, "Will you carry the word of love with you?" So we're talking about theosophy, and Tim, I have more questions for you, but if you have any burning desires or questions or topics you'd like to share with us, please feel free to jump in with that as well.
Well, a lot of things come up when you ask some very demanding sorts of questions.
I do.
So a lot of things do come up in the process. One of the things you were talking about was, and I forget the context, but you were saying something about remembering.
Yes, that we had all, I have wondered often if all of this intuition that we have had, for example, pulling something together like Stonehenge and then a few thousand years later looking at it and going, wow, that's great, who did that? And it was us, you know, that there's a great intuitive knowledge that we have somehow forgotten or embedded deep within us.
In
our modern world. Yes, go ahead.
No, but I know when you were saying that, it kind of keyed this whole line of thought around this whole subject of remembering and forgetting. And, you know, the poet, and as I'm saying it, I'm forgetting which of the poets it was, but our birth is a sleep and a forgetting.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But the whole idea that you express with this intuitive sort of knowledge that somehow gets lost. It seems that a lot of this gets lost almost with the very process of coming into this world. If you hold this view, which is the view that you would find in the theosophical worldview, that each of us is essentially a soul that comes into and inhabits a body for a period of time, that there's something about the density of having to try to work through this personality, you know, its mind, its body, its emotions, that has this dulling effect. And so for most of our lives, it seems, the process for us is one of trying to remember, in many ways, what it is that's been covered over during this lifetime. And we have flashes. You know, everybody has their flashes of insight or of intuitive awareness, and they occur in very strange or unexpected moments. But, you know, it seems to me that that really is what's going on. Often when I find myself talking about this, I will say that the arithmetic of spirit is it's not addition. I think most of us think we have to add something to ourselves because we don't feel complete in some kind of way. But really, it's a matter of subtraction, that all of these various things that we find ourselves clinging to, you know, this idea that I am a separate individual with a separate name, separate identities, separate nationality, separate religion from everyone else, takes us away from this perspective of the soul that is, in fact, trying to work through this brief experience of being in a body. So the remembering part, that was what I wanted.
Well, what a powerful comment. And you know, just for me, that rings so true in a very deep way about humanity, about every single one of us. You know, I read recently a Welsh proverb that said that we're just here, you know, for this short time between two eternities, you know, wherever, like, we came from and wherever going. Next, and yes, I would agree that, you know, settling into this physical body, into this humanity, and living here on this earth, and we still seem to be struggling with it as a as a larger issue, you know, which is would probably just raise more questions then, you know, about our origins as human beings. Now, theosophy as a practice, I realize that there's such a great history and there's so much here, and we're just really just touching the iceberg today, the tip of it. You know, when we talk about ageless wisdom and what human consciousness or awareness we might have going way, way back, you know, all the way back up until now, is basically what we're looking at and exploring. What about the practice then, to be a theosophist? What does this touch on in terms of ethics or practice or meditation? What are some of the things that fill in your practice?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, just one of the things that is the approach taken by the Theosophical Society is that there's no prescribed sort of practice, or there's no prescribed even beliefs, just the idea that there is this universal oneness of humanity and of all life is the only thing that's sort of prescribed. Otherwise, why bother with this? But in terms of guidelines for an effective practice, it always comes down to three basic things that would be study, meditation, and service are the three pillars that you could say of a spiritual practice. And that's, you know, that's the Theosophical Society, and that's probably any valid practice. But, you know, study is particularly trying to come to some sort of understanding of, it begins with, who am I? That seems to be where most people's deep questioning begins. And where do I fit in this greater pattern? And so once you start to actually focus on that, if you're pointing yourself in that seriously, you'll start to come in contact with things that are going to make you start asking deeper questions. And, you know, what is it that constitutes me? What am I composed of? You know, I know about the body, and I've been focused on that. We, most of us, kind of get locked there for a long time.
Right.
But then there are other levels of being. Theosophy would actually distinguish seven. So, you know, the personality aspect would be composed of the lower parts of that. So you have the body and the emotions and the lower mind. And that's where we tend to live most of the time. But once we start to feel that there's something more, then we ask questions. And so then you start to explore. And what you find is that throughout the ages, there have been great people who have spoken about the nature of the human being and the cosmos. And so that starts your mind to thinking. So there's an intellectual component, which is the study part. Meditation is very important because, in a sense, information has great value, but information transforms nothing. You know, some of the most informed people I have ever known have been sometimes some of the more callous or some of the more self-centered individuals that you find. And, you know, all of these sorts of Wall Street fiascos that have been going on reveal that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Information obviously isn't enough. Study won't do it.
Right.
But it does give a certain structure. So once you have a structure, then it needs to be informed, filled with something. And meditation is what actually, I guess you could say, opens the tap that then brings the water to fill this vessel, this informative vessel you've created. So when you have to actually sit quietly with yourself, one of the first things that tends to happen is that for most people who have not had any experience with it, it seems as if your mind is in riot. You can't, you know, it's jumping all around. They call it the monkey mind.
Yeah.
Because like
it's chaos.
From tree to tree. And, you know, for a while, certainly, that seems to be the pattern. But with just limited experience and then with deeper experience, you start to be able to actually move beyond the chatter of the thought. The quote that I like most about meditation, you know, everybody asks, what is meditation? And there was a fellow, Lama Anagarika Govinda. Somebody asked him that. And his response was, meditation is not what you think.
Mm. Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's
when I
great.
First heard it, my reaction was, well, how does he know what I think?
Yeah. And my question is, what is it then?
Yeah, but obviously,
that's a great quote.
Meditation actually begins at the point where thought ends. When we are no longer engrossed in the thought process, then you actually experience meditation. And that's something that's a capacity for everyone.
Yeah.
A lot of people get there just spontaneously. You know, you can look at a sunset on a given day and find that your thoughts and your whole, you know, all the normal thing of being wrapped up in your thoughts and your moods and your anxieties disappears.
Yeah, it just cuts right through, you know, to observe something like that.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. You can, you know, it's more powerful than anything you might be ruminating about at the moment. It cuts right through, and there's that instant connection.
Yeah. And then the final thing, of course, is a service aspect.
Yeah.
Because very often, you know, you can have good information, you can meditate, but then, you know, you're a very informed meditator, and that's it. You're not doing any particular good for anyone else.
Right.
So there's always the final component, which is that in some way, all of this is to benefit the world around you and those others that we find dwelling in it. And so we have to find a way to actually serve. And that actually makes the real deeper connection. And that opens up these powers we talked about before of compassion, mm-hmm. of love. In the absence of others, compassion, love is meaningless.
Mm.
It requires others for it to be actually something that's really expressed. So those three things are the main practical aspects of a theosophical approach.
Mm. Thank you very much, Tim, for that. Now, I discovered something called the secret doctrine,
mm-hmm.
and I just want to ask about one part of it at this point in the program, that the third point, that all souls are identical with the universal oversoul, which is itself an aspect of the unknown reality. I love that word, oversoul. I think Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote an essay, of course, on the oversoul, and perhaps was part of this back, you know, in the 1800s. Could you describe for us, especially since the people often find the word God to be a loaded word, and that, in fact, can impede, you know, finding some common ground. What is the oversoul, and how are all souls identical with it?
There's a beautiful little prayer, actually, that was penned by someone who was a member of the Theosophical Society many years ago. And it's called O Hidden Life. And I think it expresses this idea. It says, O hidden life, vibrant in every atom. O hidden light, shining in every creature. O hidden love, embracing all in oneness. May all who feel themselves as one with thee know they are therefore one with every other. So the idea of a hidden life, a hidden light, a hidden love that is found throughout everything. You know, we're not just talking people here. We're talking about what we would describe as inanimate. So, you know, stone, plants, animals, people are all, you could say, ensouled by this one life. And oftentimes people, in trying to talk about this sort of thing, use the example of an ocean, where you have waves that appear on the ocean, and each wave is seemingly separate, has its own qualities, but really it's something that is of the very essence of this ocean out of which it arises. And so I think that kind of those kind of images are what's used to give some deeper meaning to this idea. Obviously, it has its root in this sense that there is an absolute out of which all things emanate, but that the absolute itself is really beyond description. In Taoism, the word Lao Tzu, he says, the Tao, which is, you know, the way or the absolute that can be described, is not the eternal Tao. So we make attempts to describe it, but some people will use the word God. And that's not a problem, except everybody needs to kind of agree on what the word means when somebody says it.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Now, theosophy postulates a cyclic universe and also one with purpose. Can you share a little bit about the purpose, or what might be the purpose of our, perhaps our universes as we perceive?
Well, it does seem as if there is an unfoldment of greater and greater capacity that seems to be occurring wherever it is that you look. The idea that's often expressed, or an image is used, is as if there's a seed, and that this seed goes through the various phases we're aware of. And, you know, that seed could be the seed of a universe, or it could be the seed of this individual human life. But that in every case, what we find is that there is this unfoldment of deeper and deeper potentials toward what end, you know, you can speculate, but it's something that is part of the process, and these sorts of cycles seem to be something that's a part of just everything that we see. You know, the cycles of day and night, sleep, awakeness, birth, death, rebirth would be one of the cycles that would be spoken of.
Right.
All of those things are part of this kind of cyclic unfoldment.
And that's fascinating, because at this time, it must be a very interesting time, I imagine, because the ageless wisdom is coming in much closer contact now with what science is able to explore, and specifically like the space sciences and the particle sciences, looking at the universe in terms of dark energy or dark matter, being able to perceive more out there that, you know, on some level we intuit and are a part of, almost as a part of, but also as a mirror. Does science right now actually help to bolster people's spiritual life?
Well, I think the science of today certainly does. I mean, in one respect, although I'm not, no one's going to accuse me of being a quantum physicist, but I think from what I understand of the directions of quantum physics particularly, is that really the world or the universe that we live in has been largely dematerialized. It is not a matter of little atomic particles that create this world that we see, but it's something, you know, the sort of quantum phenomena that are spoken of are really not tied to the matter of the world before the previous thinking. So it seems to be something where science has moved to that border between spirit and matter. And it's something that seems to be opening a new way of seeing the door, seeing the world. They've moved much closer together.
Yeah.
It used to be that religion and science, you would say, were opposed.
In many places they still are.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not even go into evolution theory.
No, that's a whole other program.
Right. But yeah, I think that it's something where the science of today actually supports someone who has a view of inner potential and the potential for unfoldment and the value of spirit.
Yes, sort of making the connections more lately. Now, I have time to ask you another question, and I'm going to ask about theosophy. How does it help us, given all that you've shared, to relate to others in relationship, and particularly in helping to affect religious tolerance?
Well, one of the main features of theosophy is that it really, in order to embrace it seriously, it requires a sense of self-responsibility. That basically you have, each person has the capacity to choose and the capacity to understand. And that as we really ask serious questions about who am I? What am I doing here? You start to find that there are not just similarities, but that every single person is constituted in the same way. That the emotional natures, the thought natures of all of us, we share these things. And we influence each other through the power of our thinking and through the kind of lives that we live. And so it gives you the sense that you do have the possibility to affect others and to choose how you will do that, to make the choice that you're not just going to cave into the fears that are promoted through all of the different sort of media channels, for instance.
Yeah.
To make the choice that you're not just going to accept a view that this is a spiraling down sort of world and it's a dog-eat-dog kind of place, but to actually recognize that we share a planet and that we share a certain makeup, and everybody that I've ever met wants to experience happiness, and that there are ways that we can contribute to that. So you become a responsible actor in this world.
Thank you so much, Tim, for your answers and your wisdom today. I know that for more information, our listeners can go to theosophical.org. And I also wanted to let everyone know, as we come to the end of the program, that all of your contact information and website and other works and projects of the Society will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today and sharing about theosophy, and perhaps we can speak again in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Kier.
Best of luck.
Okay.
Now, before we close the program, listeners, I wanted to share with you a tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. And in part, it was something that Tim was talking about a little bit earlier, which was really not needing anything more to add to yourself for this journey. I have been drawn to mystical quests in my life at various times, and felt close to various spiritual luminaries through history, and Francis and Claire of Assisi have been rather central in my own development and experience. So I went to visit some years back. I went to Assisi to see where they lived and walked, and I want to share a reflection with you on that. It seemed to rise from the rich brown Umbrian earth, as though lifted high on the upraised olive branches of the orchards in the valley beneath it. I didn't need a map to find this ancient city not far from Rome, even when arriving by car in the dead of night. The road turned a bit, and suddenly there she was, a medieval beacon, a city of hearts on a hill. My tired feet found their way into town through the porta, the gate beside the basilica. I was quietly welcomed by my hosts, got a good hot meal, and even a souvenir before my head finally surrendered into the deep down of my awaiting pillow. Black night, guarded by Sister Moon, was stark and silent, more silent than expected for this famous place of pilgrimage. It began to rain, then thunder rolled along the hills surrounding me in this valley, its haunting sound gathering momentum and volume in the dark around me, until I found myself staring wide-eyed at the dark from my little bed, wondering if it was true what they told me as a child about angels tap dancing. Morning arrived gently as Brother Sun coaxed me from bed to peek from the balcony at dark fish-scale rooftops, wet cobblestones, the misty morning hills. It was late summer when I finally arrived at Assisi and the place I had longed to see for years, San Damiano. I stood at the top of a cobblestone path that led rather steeply down to this renowned church that St. Francis rebuilt stone by stone. The path was exceedingly smooth, cobbles and mortar worn so fine over the centuries by the pilgrimages of many souls. And here I was, wearing new sandals, strappy little leather sandals, Italian with shiny, smooth soles. There was virtually no friction between my shoes and the steep, smooth path, so I baby-stepped a little down the slippery stones, sliding here and again and once more. It was a terribly difficult and uncomfortable approach to my journey's end, and one that had taken me completely by surprise. I tried various moves, such as walking down sideways a piece, and I found myself wishing for sneakers or hiking boots or any other soulful option I left back at the hotel. Frustrated, I finally asked an unseen entity, "How on earth people walked here?" And the answer came as softly as the September breeze, an answer that would remind me that I needed to bring no firmer grasp or special preparation or tools to my spiritual journey. Take off your sandals. I removed my shoes, stored them in my tote, and stepped onto the stones with bare feet. The stones were warm, soft, welcoming. From then on, walking was simple, silent, an immediate connection to those who walked there long ago before me. But Francis had learned this already too. Christianity is a cobblestone religion, best lived out on foot. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. And please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.